Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 30th of May, these are our main stories. Israel is to hold an unprecedented second general election within months after the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, failed to form a coalition. The US Special Counsel Robert Mueller, in his first public comments on his investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election, has declined to clear President Trump of obstruction of justice. Cuba is loosening some of its controls over the internet. Also in this podcast...
I am so relieved, you've no idea. I said this morning, you know, I didn't see anything going on. But, you know, accidents happen, things do happen. And now, here it is.
A painstaking operation to move a Banksy mural from the walls of a garage in Wales to a nearby art gallery has been successful. Israeli politicians have voted to dissolve parliament and hold a snap election after the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, failed to form a coalition. The polls, scheduled for the 17th of September, will be the second this year, an unprecedented event in Israeli politics. Mr. Netanyahu won last month's vote, but without enough seats to govern alone. I got the latest from Tom Bateman, our correspondent in Jerusalem.
Well, what we had in the very closing hours, as the clocks ticked past midnight, was the Israeli parliament voting to dissolve itself. And I mean, remember, these are MPs that were voted into office just over 6 weeks ago and have now effectively sacked themselves before even passing a single law. And the reason this has happened is because Benjamin Netanyahu has been unable to hammer out an agreement between two sides of the coalition government that he wanted to put together. And this was over a long-standing issue, a long-standing dispute in Israel between ultra-Orthodox conservative religious groups and a secular party about whether young men from ultra-Orthodox communities should be made to serve in the army as national conscription, as all other young Jewish people have to do in Israel. Now, he couldn't reach that agreement. He was facing a situation where the Israeli president could have gone to an opposition MP and asked them to form a government. So instead, he precipitated this vote in the Israeli parliament, and there will now be elections. But I mean, this really represents a serious political failure for the Israeli prime minister. And although he has said that he didn't want this to happen, the fact remains that it's really him that has pushed it through. He has said tonight that he will win again.
Well, he may win again, but what makes this even more fraught for him is the fact that he's facing possible corruption charges.
He is, and I think this has been in the background to all of this. Later this year, he will have a hearing with the country's Attorney General over corruption charges, which he has vehemently denied. But these have been, I think, an undercurrent in all of these discussions, because those MPs that are loyal to Mr. Netanyahu have argued that he should have immunity from prosecution while he is in government, while he's in office. And the theory is that that has become a condition for people becoming members of the coalition government. And I think also there are those like Avigdor Lieberman, who's been on the side of trying to push through this proposed military draft law, who are perhaps sensing that the Netanyahu era is entering its closing stages and prepared to dig their heels in a way that really shows Mr. Netanyahu's increasing political weakness and vulnerability.
Tom Bateman in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu's wife, Sara, has reportedly struck a plea bargain deal over accusations she wrongly used state money to pay for hundreds of meals. The case involved $100,000 worth of food supplied by Jerusalem restaurants. Mrs. Netanyahu was alleged to have bought them with public funds, while falsely saying there were no chefs available to cook at the Prime Minister's official residence. According to Israeli media reports, she's agreed to pay a fine and reimburse the state more than $12,000. The US Special Counsel Robert Mueller has broken his silence on his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election and possible obstruction of justice. Mr. Mueller said that charging the president for a federal crime was not an option because of the Constitution.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office.
Mr. Mueller confirmed that Russian agents had systematically tried to influence the election, but there was insufficient evidence to bring charges related to a broader conspiracy. He went on to explain that if members of the House and Senate wanted him to appear in front of their congressional committees, he wouldn't have anything new to say.
No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
I spoke to our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, who listened to Mr. Mueller's speech.
After 2 years of complete silence, of course, from the special counsel, didn't say anything for that whole period, did he? Here he is standing in front of the cameras, essentially setting out the findings of his report again, in brief at any rate, standing by his view that he couldn't come to a conclusion on the question of obstruction, that if he'd been able to, he would have said so. He would have said that the president definitely didn't do it, but he wasn't able to say that, and saying that even if he had, he wouldn't have been able to indict him, and really kicking the ball on to Congress to do what they will if they wish to take it further. He's clearly made it clear it's up to them to do it.
Mr. Mueller has chosen to remain silent for so long. Why do you think he picked this particular moment to finally speak out publicly?
I mean, the last few weeks have seen some pretty intense negotiations between him and Democrats on Capitol Hill, because, of course, they, who now control the committees up there, Judiciary Committee in particular, want him to come and testify about his report. And so what I think you're seeing today is him saying, look, you know, I can perhaps be forced to come and do that, but I'm saying nothing more than you already know. I'm not going to say any more than that. The report is out there. Here's what it concludes. And that's all I'm going to be able to say. The Democrats, wanted a push on the underlying evidence and things like that. That could all end up in the courts. But I think this is in some way a sort of a public statement of what he's probably been saying to the Democrats in private for weeks.
And what's the reaction been to what Mr. Mueller has had to say? We've been hearing from Mr. Trump.
Yes, we have. A tweet, of course, saying no changes from the Mueller report. There was insufficient evidence, and therefore, in our country, a person is innocent. That person, of course, is referring to him as himself. The case is closed. Thank you. Different tone to what you might have expected from him when he called it a witch hunt and the angry Democrats and the hoax and all that kind of thing. But he clearly thinks it draws a line.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. The frontrunner for the Democratic nomination, Joe Biden, said that while no one was relishing impeaching Mr. Trump, it might be unavoidable. But the Democratic leadership is wary, fearing such a process could backfire. The Democratic chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, stopped short of calling for impeachment.
It falls to Congress to respond to the crimes, lies, and other wrongdoing of President Trump. We will do so. Make no mistake, no one, not even the President of the United States, is above the law.
Gerald Nadler. Well, Jonathan Turley is Professor of Public Interest Law at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. My colleague, James Menendez, asked him what he made of Mr. Mueller's brief press conference.
Well, it was a rather curious press conference. It was an attempt by the special counsel to cut off demands for him to appear in Congress and to answer questions publicly. I don't think it'll be successful. There was a couple of things in the press conference, however, which were new. One is a rather glaring contradiction between his account and that of Attorney General Bill Barr. Barr has testified that Mueller told not just him, but the Deputy Attorney General, that his decision not to reach a conclusion on the crime of obstruction had nothing to do with the DOJ policy that you can't indict a sitting president. And Barr was quite clear about that Mueller was not making that argument to them. Barr also said that both he and the Deputy Attorney General, both who are superiors or supervisors of Mueller, encouraged him to reach a conclusion. So there's a rather sharp contradiction there between Mueller and his immediate supervisors. Mueller's also making a rather novel argument that because there's a policy that you can't indict a president, they read that as meaning you can't reach a conclusion that a president could be indicted. Some of us think that that is simply dead wrong. I mean, these memos, there's two of them, one from Bill Clinton and one from Richard Nixon's administrations. Those memos say nothing about investigating a president and finding criminal conduct. They just say you can't indict a president because they don't want a president as a criminal defendant.
Just to explain that further, you could produce the evidence or you could lay out the evidence, speak to the witnesses, but you just couldn't take it any further. Is that what you mean?
That's right. Those memos had nothing to do with independent or special counsels. It only dealt with actually charging a president who would then have to be a defendant and a president at the same time. That doesn't say anything about what a special counsel does. So it was rather confusing that he even took the job. I mean, for 2 years, everyone expected him to reach a conclusion, and it turns out that he never thought he could reach a conclusion if there was evidence of a crime.
And what about this phrase, though, which stood out for me? He said, if we had confidence the president did not commit a crime, we would have said so. I mean, that in a way seems fairly clear.
Yeah, it also seems somewhat passive-aggressive, doesn't it? I mean, it's saying, well, we honestly didn't, you know, exonerate him, and we would have told you if we thought that he was clear of any possible wrongdoing. But it also leads to this question of exactly what are you doing now? I mean, you just said that there was evidence that kept you from saying he was innocent, and yet you wouldn't reach a conclusion. What's the difference between those two positions? So it's a very confusing position for the special counsel to take. And I think that, frankly, it's simply wrong. I think that his staff decided that they did not want to reach a decision on obstruction. The biggest problem that he faces is that the attorney general and the deputy attorney general did reach conclusions. So according to Mueller, did they violate DOJ policy? I don't think so. So none of this makes a lot of sense to me, quite frankly, and it's gotten even more nonsensical after this press conference. And that leads us to the other big takeaway, which is he won't answer any further questions.
But could he testify, for example, before Congress, especially now he's stepping down?
Well, he is still going to be subject to any executive privilege arguments made by the White House. Whether you're a current or former special counsel, you are obligated to follow DOJ policy and directions. So I don't think he's going to contest that. But what he's saying is that he doesn't want to testify, and he won't testify beyond the four corners of the report. So he's basically telling Congress, if you pull me in there, I'm just going to read from the report. That, again, is a rather curious position. Congress has a right to ask him questions.
Professor Jonathan Turley, Professor of Public Interest Law at George Washington University. The European Union has issued a scathing annual report on Turkey, a candidate for membership, accusing it of moving further away from the EU. Mark Lowen has the details.
The EU's annual Turkey Progress Report is getting steadily worse. On a litany of issues, the verdict is withering, from the abuse of fundamental freedoms to the purge of at least 200,000 people after the attempted coup, from the crackdown on the opposition to the violation of judicial independence, and from scant progress in fighting corruption to provocative moves towards neighbouring Cyprus. There is praise for how Turkey shelters some 4 million refugees, the largest community in the world. But based on this report, Turkey's decades-held dream of EU accession has no chance of moving forward.
Mark Lowen. Cuba has announced that it's legalising private Wi-Fi networks as well as the importation of equipment such as routers. Will Grant has more.
The relaxation of the rules governing Wi-Fi networks is a significant step on an island with still some of the tightest internet restrictions in the world. For everyday users, it could mean a reduction in costs as previously illegal neighbourhood-level Wi-Fi networks will spring up, with now little likelihood of being broken up by the authorities. For small business owners, the potential benefits are especially attractive, bringing the opportunity of opening internet cafes or providing Wi-Fi to their customers, something that until now wasn't allowed. The internet hardware and infrastructure can be brought into the country from abroad, with supposedly none of the meticulous controls which were previously enforced. Many Cubans, though, are used to hearing that the rules are changing and will wait to see that the restrictions have genuinely been lifted before believing that the internet will now become more widely available.
Will Grant. Also in the podcast,
a danger to the public order is how the judges describe the Hells Angels. A court in Utrecht used the gang's own slogan to explain the ban, calling them a one-percenter club, a club of outlaws.
A court in the Netherlands has banned the Biker Club, making the country the first to outlaw the entire organisation. Now, it's the holy month of Ramadan, with many worshippers around the world participating in the religious fast. In Nigeria, where roughly half the 200 million population is Muslim, it can be a challenging period. For some of the faithful, difficult economic conditions mean they have to continue to engage in strenuous jobs to make ends meet. The BBC's Ishak Khalid went to meet labourers in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The holy month of Ramadan is a period of rigorous acts of worship for devotees, fasting from dawn to sunset, and increasing prayers. Here at the National Mosque, Abuja, people are trooping into the magnificent structure to listen to Ramadan preaching, known as tafsir, and to pray. This is a site where building materials like cement, gravels have been sold, and there are laborers here, a lot of laborers, most of them young men. I can see some of them packing the gravels, others loading bags of cement onto trucks. Some of them carrying as much as 100 kilograms of cement on their head. And they are doing this as they observe the Ramadan fast. Salis Ibrahim dropped out of school at the age of 12 because his parents could not afford the school fees.
If I do not do this hard labor, I have no other source of income. It's quite difficult, but we have to do it, even though we are fasting, which is a religious obligation. When we start in the morning, we don't usually have problems because we have the strength. But normally in the afternoon, like from 2 p.m., we find it very difficult. We become tired and weak. Sometimes, some of us even abandon the work because they can't cope.
Salisu and his colleagues work for 10 to 13 hours daily, usually in harsh temperatures of 30 to 40 degrees during the daytime. He earns between $5 and $15 a day.
My life is very difficult. I always hope one day I will get out of this hard labor.
There is little time to rest. They pour water on their heads to cool off, then return to work. Nigeria is one of the top oil producers in the world, but it has the highest rate of extreme poverty according to World Poverty Clock. And government figures indicate that unemployment is around 23%. Many, therefore, resort to hard labor to survive. Islamic clerics say Muslims whose livelihoods involve strenuous activities can suspend their fast once combining the two becomes extremely difficult and threatens their health or life.
You know, Islam is the religion of mercy, and it is the religion of hard work.
Sheikh Muhammad Kabir Adam is one of the imams at Nigeria's National Mosque, Abuja.
So somebody who experiences hardship, he cannot bear the fasting and his job that he is doing to earn the livelihood. He started the fasting, but he cannot make it. Therefore, he stopped doing the fasting on that day. Then he can pay that day in a suitable time for him.
But Salisu feels he can cope for the time being. It's the end of the day and time to breakfast. Salisu and his colleagues attend a local eatery.
Alhamdulillah.
We thank God. and are looking forward to coming out to work again tomorrow.
Salisu Ibrahim ending that report by Ishak Khalid in Nigeria. Now to the Netherlands, and a court has banned the biker club Hell's Angels, making the country the first to outlaw the entire club, and not just some of its chapters. From the Netherlands, Anna Holligan reports.
A danger to the public order is how the judges describe the Hell's Angels. A court in Utrecht used the gang's own slogan to explain the ban, calling them a one-percenter club, a club of outlaws, a phrase often used by motorcycle clubs rebelling against national laws. This is part of a broader campaign by Dutch authorities to cut the criminal activities often associated with these gangs. Two rival clubs were also recently outlawed. The countrywide ban comes after 17 members were arrested in Portugal last week on suspicion of threatening national security.
Anna Holligan. The Cricket World Cup begins here in England on Thursday. It will follow an opening ceremony outside Buckingham Palace. 10 teams are taking part in a marathon tournament spread over the next 7 weeks. It's claimed to be the world's third biggest sports event of its kind, behind football and rugby, and it's expected to attract a global audience of well over a billion. Alex Capstick has been assessing cricket's popularity and the various challenges facing the sport.
Afghanistan supporters enjoying themselves at a World Cup warm-up match, like the players getting ready for what's been described as the planet's greatest cricket celebration. It's also claimed to be one of the most lucrative and most watched sporting events, holding its own in an age when T20 cricket, the shortest version of the game, has become increasingly dominant. Steve Elworthy, a losing semi-finalist for South Africa when the competition was last held in England back in 1999, is in charge of organising this one.
It's amazing when you use those words, World Cup. When you say those words, that it's the third biggest global sporting tournament in the world, that is huge. It's a massive. When you think of the following, the viewership that the ICC are expecting around the world, over 1.5 billion people, never mind your digital engagement and your radio, it is a massive event.
And that's out. Yes, it's all over this time. Lost his nerve in the end, did Michael Holland, tried to swing.
Cricket's global fan base, its appeal to broadcasters and sponsors can be traced back to the 1983 World Cup, when India surprised everyone by winning it. The second most populous nation in the world became obsessed with the game, and gradually big business cashed in.
Well, this is an event to celebrate the great Indian cricketers, past and present. And it's taking place in the Nursery Pavilion at Lords. This is the scene of India's first victory in the World Cup in 1983, and the captain that day, Kapil Dev, should be joining us on the red carpet very shortly.
You must have fond memories of this place, 1983.
Special memory, yes. Every ball was a memory. Anybody who played cricket, this is the place where you want to come and play and enjoy.
You were credited with that performance in 1983, transforming the game in India. I mean, what impact do you think it made on cricket up until today?
I don't think only 83. Yes, we are part and parcel of taking the game ahead. I think cricket is changing every decade, so a lot of credit goes to the media, television and technology.
Recent research suggested more than 90% of cricket fans across the world come from the Indian subcontinent. It's no surprise that the group match between India and Pakistan attracted nearly 500,000 ticket applications. But the game faces a challenge elsewhere. Even here in England, cricket is battling to engage a younger audience. The former national team captain Michael Vaughan views this event, in which England are one of the favourites, as a pivotal moment in the sport.
It's an opportunity the game here in England can't miss. This is now the time that the players and the administrators get together and say, right, the product has to be one that we're all talking about on the pitch. We can't have any off-field dramas. And the players have got an incredible opportunity to go and sell themselves, sell the game, and sell the England team, where everyone should be watching the game.
With a global audience of over a billion people, but both the World Cup and the game we love are under threat from individuals looking to corrupt and exploit you.
Cricket can be a thrilling spectacle, but high-profile scandals have damaged its reputation. Corruption remains the biggest scourge. All the players at the World Cup have been shown this video, which identifies suspected match fixers. Alex Marshall, the head of the governing body's anti-corruption unit, has contacted them with a warning to stay away, part of a range of measures designed to protect the tournament's integrity.
You can never guarantee that any event will be free of an issue. What I can say is the corruptors know how well protected this event is, and we have an anti-corruption manager with every single squad, not just at the matches, away from the matches, looking out for these people. And it's around a dozen people who have had the disinvite and who we will keep away. And if any more pop up, we'll be speaking to them as well.
So the preparations are complete, the teams are ready to go, tickets have sold well. One factor the organisers have no control over is, of course, the English weather. Fingers crossed on that one.
That report by Alex Capstick. A mural by the elusive artist Banksy has been moved from its previous home on two walls of a garage in Port Talbot in South Wales to a new museum in the town centre. The artwork, painted in December last year, was cut out of the walls and loaded onto the back of a lorry. The mural near the steel plant in the town depicts a child enjoying what appears to be snow, but it's actually ash from a nearby burning industrial bin. The art dealer, John Brandler, who paid a six-figure sum for the artwork, expressed his delight that it had arrived safely.
I am so relieved, you've no idea. I said this morning, you know, I didn't see anything going on, but, you know, accidents happen, things do happen, and now here it is, and I am so relieved. The only thing I have to worry about now is not falling asleep on the motorway driving home.
I heard more about the big move from the BBC's Will Fife, who's in Wales.
Moving an expensive and a precious piece of artwork is difficult at the best of times and takes a lot of planning. But obviously with this piece, we're talking about the corner of what is essentially a concrete garage. I mean, it weighs 4.5 tonnes itself. So just to be able to move an object that big and that heavy and to do it in one piece takes an awful lot of work. So, you know, the groundwork to this started weeks ago with the engineers sort of digging holes around it, testing the surroundings, because actually there was an added layer of sort of complication to it in the fact that former steelworker Ian Lewis, who owns the garage, had built it himself about 20 years ago just as a bit of an odd job to keep his car safe. So obviously at that point he wasn't thinking about the structural integrity of it. So engineers have had to really assess his handiwork in this move as well.
Indeed, and it was very stressful for Mr. Lewis himself. He's very relieved that this operation was successful.
He is very relieved. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he is quite a shy man, a man that doesn't particularly like the public eye. So when this first happened to him back in December and sort of all of the world's press and publicity arrived on his driveway and started asking him for interviews and sort of recording the back of his garage, which is obviously quite close to his home, it hit him quite hard. And I think people often think about getting a Banksy painted on your wall a little bit like winning the lottery. But for someone like Ian, it really wasn't the case. And actually today, I think from speaking to him, it's been a bit of a weight lifted off his shoulders to finally have it physically clear of his property and across the other end of the town.
Will Fife in South Wales and the Banksy artwork depicting a child enjoying what appears to be falling snowflakes. All from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.